Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This week's show is a Valentine addressed to Appalachia. We'll hear from writers who love this region, including fantasy writer Neil Gaiman, who says some of his stories were inspired by Appalachian folktales.
Books of mine, like American Gods, in some ways began with my readings of the Appalachian folktales.
But some say their love for Appalachia is complicated. We'll talk with writer Ann Pancake, who said while growing up in West Virginia, she always wanted to get as far away from the region as she could.
It seems even stronger in West Virginia, this constant pull to come back, but also a constant push to leave. I think that's also, so most of us live, I think, with that contradiction, both the attraction of the place and the repulsion of the place.
And we'll hear an interview with debut novelist Carrie Mullins, whose book Night Garden, about growing up in eastern Kentucky, is about the struggle many young people here face fighting drug addiction.
And when I moved back, it seemed like there was a whole generation that had just been really decimated. There's no other way to say it. They'd been decimated by what was going on there in terms of drugs. These were kids that I knew growing up, and it was across all class lines. It was everybody.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Living in Appalachia, it's not always easy. Some people even compare their feelings for this place as being involved in a difficult, sometimes turbulent relationship. Today on our show, in honor of Valentine's Day, we wanted to bring you voices from people who've written love letters for Appalachia, of a sort. And like most loves, this love, well, it's complicated. Some of the folks we'll hear on our show grew up in these mountains and were eager to move away, but when they did, they felt a strong homesickness that seemed to draw them back. And they realized that their love for Appalachia, well, it's a love for a place that isn't quite perfect. In a little bit, we're going to hear British fantasy writer Neil Gaiman tell us why Appalachian folktales inspired him to write. But first, we're going to hear from a very realistic novelist who tells the story of a young girl who faces a terrifying struggle with opioid addiction. Carrie Mullins is a novelist from eastern Kentucky. She returned from college to find that her community had been devastated by the opioid crisis. So she decided to write a coming-of-age novel based on the frightening realities facing many young Appalachians. Roxy Todd spoke with Mullins about her novel.
Do you want to start just by reading a little bit from towards the beginning of the book? Maybe one of the first times, it seems, that Marie's experiencing drugs?
Sure. I'll set it up a little bit and then start reading. Marie's gone to Miss Anglin's house, and they've actually done some drugs. They did a couple lines of OxyContin. The party by the fire and the car were moving toward each other across time and space. They would meet, and everyone would be together, and Marie would be there, too. Everything made Marie laugh. Miss Anglin's car window that wouldn't roll down. The whiny man on the CD player singing and playing guitar. And finally, the car and the party did meet in space and time, and the car stopped. Marie felt herself glide out of the car and around the mud pit and down the road to the party. Marie wanted to talk to everyone there. She had something to say, even to people she'd never seen before. Marie felt taller, and she liked the way she felt when she walked, like her joints were jangling, like she was tall and limber, moving easy over the ground. And it felt like everyone noticed her and wanted to talk to her as much as she wanted to talk to them. Everything was happening for a reason, and she knew what that reason was, even if she couldn't say it out loud. Nobody reminded her of anything, and everybody at the party was good. The only thing missing was water. She wanted to dive into a pool and swim, or a lake, or a river, or something. It would have felt so good to move her body around in some water. It would have made the night totally complete. Marie ran into Miss Anglin, and she was saying to no one, "How did we come to be here?" She was saying it over and over again, not talking to Marie or anyone else, asking God, it seemed like, with her palms up, cigarette burning in one hand, head cocked to one side. "Man, that's all I want to know. I want to know how we came to be here." She shook her head and brought the cigarette to her lips, left the other arm outstretched. "And here's the other thing I need to know." She paused and blew out a stream of smoke. "Why is he not here?" That pissed Marie off. She knew what Miss Anglin was talking about. She knew who Miss Anglin was talking about. Miss Anglin, who Shane was done with, who he was trying to get away from, was now bringing him up. When all Marie wanted to do was get away, forget about the way her mother wailed at the funeral and the broken shell that was left of her dad. Why was she talking about this now, just when Marie had almost been able to forget what happened? Even just for a few hours, Miss Anglin ruined it.
And Shane, who Marie's talking about right there, is her brother who passed away just before this scene, or a few weeks, I think, before the scene. And can you talk a little bit about Marie's parents and how they kind of, you mentioned that this tragedy, really, they weren't able to cope. They weren't prepared for this terrible tragedy as he was going off to college, as you mentioned. How did Marie's parents respond to this?
Well, her dad kind of really fell into a fog. He just wasn't able to cope. I guess he was probably pretty depressed. And her mom was just kind of absent, I think. She just threw herself into her work and her other commitments, and I think that's how she coped with it. And it kind of left Marie to her own devices, in a way.
Yeah, it definitely opens up the debate of if her parents had been a little more supportive or been there, would Marie have fallen into this pattern of drug abuse and made these friends, and really essentially she leaves home, and that it does seem as if she probably wouldn't have had that vacuum at home. She might not have left and joined these other people. Is that kind of how you thought about her, I guess, downward spiral into drug abuse and with this other group of people?
Yeah, I think she was looking for a family when she found the Owenses. And even though they were wild and they were a lot different than her own family, I think she wanted that and she craved it. And that's one of the main reasons why she fell in with them, I think.
Yeah, and in the beginning, she's really drawn to them. She's drawn to Bobo. He's sort of like the superstar among his family members, but he also just embodies this like ultra physical buff. You know, he does canoeing. She's enchanted with him. Bobo is kind of the older brother. He's older 20s, maybe about 30, Marie guesses, and he's been working construction in Indiana and comes back. Can you describe a little bit how Marie sees him in those first few scenes and who he is and what his dreams are?
Yeah, so when Bobo's been in Indiana and he's been, like you said, working construction, he's been saving his money because he wants to come back home and start a Outfitters, right? He wants to, it's a beautiful place. His county, Larkin County, is beautiful. And they have a river, and he wants to set up a store down there, kind of an outfitter store, and rent canoes and kayaks and do excursions on the river. That's his big hope and dream. That's the legitimate side of what he wants to do anyway.
Who in your life were you thinking of when you wrote this book, when you thought about Bobo and you thought about Marie and wanted to write about these characters?
Well, there are a lot of people, really. I moved back to my home county in about 2003. I lived in Lexington for quite a while and worked up here. And when I moved back, it seemed like there was a whole generation that had just been really decimated. There's no other way to say it. They'd been decimated by what was going on there in terms of drugs. These were kids that I knew growing up. These were kids that I taught how to swim at the swimming pool and knew from teaching vacation Bible school. And it was across all class lines. It was everybody. And so that's what I started from. And I also started from, especially with Bobo, because, you know, you see people, and maybe you didn't know them before they became addicted. When you're addicted, I think it's hard to be human in a way, and it's hard to see people who are addicted as human sometimes. But I wanted to think about Bobo as a kid. You know, Bobo is definitely a kid's nickname, right? So that's kind of why I even gave him the name, because he was a kid at one point, and he had dreams, he had big ambitions, but like a lot of people, the addiction really overpowers that drive and interest. So that's who I was thinking about when I wrote those characters.
It is such a roller coaster of a book. I enjoyed it. I think it's really important for us to kind of put ourselves in the shoes of people, because there's all kinds of ways that people get addicted and fall into lives of chaos and despair. But, you know, empathy in some ways is probably one of the things that we can do better and better. And your book does a really great job, I think, of helping bring someone's life into a sort of, we become more aware of what it really is like to go through this girl's shoes. So I thank you for that. I think it's really important. What brought you to want to do this book as a coming of age book right now?
Well, kind of along the lines of what you were saying, and I thank you for those comments, because that's exactly what I was trying to do. I really, in a way, wanted to, it's a fictional book, of course, but in a way I wanted to make a record of what's going on in my area and with the people that I love in my area.
Do you have children?
I do, yeah. I got two girls. I got one that just turned 14 and one who will be 10 next week.
In writing this, Marie's 17. Were you thinking as you were writing Marie, like, what if this happened to my daughter? What would I do? Or were you wondering as a parent what you would do in a situation like this?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's been so widespread, and it, you know, and you look at people in your county and you know people that you've grown up with who've succumbed. You know, I know a lot of people who've passed away. Yeah, it's something I think about every day. And it's, I mean, you could do, I know people, parents and brothers and sisters of people who've been addicted. It's super hard to pinpoint when it starts or why it starts. So it's something you have to be, I think you do as a parent, you think about it all that I do all the time.
And have you, when you were 17, what was it like for you during that time? Did you ever face any kind of alcohol or drug interactions or addictions that kind of came up as you were writing this book?
Sure. Yeah. I don't know how much I want to get into this. I don't want my kids to hear this quite yet. But, yeah, I think everybody at 17, and that's the thing, too, is that your brain isn't really fully formed at that age. You know, you don't always have the best judgment. And one step, one thing you do when you're that age could influence and impact your whole life. And that's what I think about with Marie. She made a couple not so great decisions, and the outcome is going to be with her forever. And it's the weird thing about being 17 is because you're old enough to do these things and have a little more freedom. But you don't always realize the impact that your decisions are going to have on the rest of your life.
That was Kentucky novelist Carrie Mullen speaking with Roxy Todd. Mullen's new novel is called Night Garden. We're going to take a quick break. Still to come, we'll hear from writers Neil Gaiman, Charles Frazier, and Nikki Giovanni. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Thank you to all of our listeners who donated to West Virginia Public Broadcasting during our recent fundraiser. Your support is needed now more than ever. We're a small team, and there are a lot of late nights, so seeing your personal messages letting us know why you love our show really encourages us to keep telling Appalachia's story. There's still time to donate to keep us on the air. Simply click the red Donate Now button on our website to make a secure donation online. That's at wvpublic.org.
You could stay here forever, if you want to.
Really?
Sure. We'll sing and play games, and Mother will cook your favorite meals.
There's one tiny little thing we need to do.
What's that?
Well, it's a surprise.
You might remember this popular movie from 2009. Coraline was a story about a girl who dreams of escaping from her realities. And when she does, Coraline discovers life back home with her family is worth fighting her way back to. The book was written by the award-winning author Neil Gaiman. He also wrote Stardust, another blockbuster hit you might have heard of. No, he's not an Appalachian, but one book was inspired by, get this, the Appalachian folk tales. Yep, the ones we Appalachians are pretty good at telling. The book is called American Gods. Let's listen to what it sounded like read by Neil Gaiman.
And along with the milk, the children as they grew drank Essie's tales of the knockers and the blue caps who lived down the mines, of the bucca, the trickiest spirit of the land, much more dangerous than the red-headed snub-nosed piskies, for whom the first fish of the catch was always left upon the shingle, and for whom a fresh-baked loaf of bread was left in the field at reaping time to ensure a fine harvest. She told them of the apple tree men, old apple trees who talked when they had a mind, and who needed to be placated with the first cider of the crop, which was poured onto their roots as the year turned, if they were to give you a fine crop for the next year. She told them in her mellifluous Cornish drawl which trees they should be wary of, in the old rhyme, elm he do brood, and oak he do hate, but the willow man goes walking if he stays out late.
That was a reading from Neil Gaiman's book, American Gods, published by HarperCollins. Gaiman was one of the featured speakers at the West Virginia Book Festival in 2015. West Virginia Public Broadcasting was one of the festival's sponsors. Jesse Wright spoke with Gaiman by phone before the festival to get a little more insight into his work.
Neil Gaiman is primarily a fiction writer. He has crafted vivid characters who inhabit worlds that straddle the familiar and the fantastical. Strands of ancient and modern mythology run through much of his work. Gaiman's love of fantasy is evident in his decades-long collaboration with Appalachian artist Charles Vess, who illustrated the novel Stardust, among many others. Anyone who has an interest in fairies has probably seen his artwork. Gaiman says Vess isn't his only connection to Appalachia, though.
But also books of mine, like American Gods, in some ways began with my readings of the Appalachian folktales, the strange things that happened, or to my mind, strange things that happened to folktales as they moved from England across the water. And the things that they would keep. They would keep a wit, they would keep the wits, they would keep the triumph of intelligence and of craftiness, but they'd lose magic. And that fascinated me. And that actually, in some ways, was the starting point for writing an entire novel, American Gods. And I don't think that people would ever point to that and go, ah, this came out of the Appalachian Jack stories. But in a lot of ways, it did.
Jack tales are a storytelling tradition here in Appalachia, but they shouldn't be confused with your ordinary campfire tale or old wives' tales. They're tall tales that revolve around a trickster character named Jack, who is always plotting some type of mischief. Think Jack and the Beanstalk. The stories are rarely told the same way twice, even by the same storyteller. Jack tales originated in Europe and Britain. As immigrants from those areas came to settle the Appalachian Mountains, they brought Jack along with them. Neil Gaiman's novel, American Gods, revolves around the idea that gods exist because people believe in them, and that when immigrants moved to the New World, they brought their religion or their beliefs with them, and therefore, their spirits and gods came along as well. Like in this scene from the book, where one of the old gods meets a believer in the New World.
There was something about the man that made her happy to look at him, and something else that whispered of danger.
You might say that you know me.
He squinted down at her, and she squinted right back up at him, searching his moon face for a clue to his identity. He looked as young as one of her own grandchildren, yet he had called her by her old name, and there was a burr in his voice she knew from her childhood, from the rocks and the moors of her home.
"You're a Cornishman."
"That I am, a cousin Jack," said the red-haired man. "Or rather that I was, but now I'm here in this new world where nobody puts out ale or milk for an honest fellow or a loaf of bread come harvest time."
The old woman steadied the bowl of peas upon her lap.
"If you're who I think you are, then I've no quarrel with you."
In the house, she could hear Phillida grumbling to the housekeeper.
Nor I with you. Although it was you that brought me here, you and a few like you, into this land with no time for magic and no place for piskies and such folk.
You've done me many a good turn.
Good and ill. We like the wind. We blows both ways.
Essie nodded.
Will you take my hand, Essie Tregowan?
And he reached out to hand to her. Freckled it was, and although Essie's eyesight was going, she could see each orange hair on the back of his hand glowing golden in the afternoon sunlight. She bit her lip. Then, hesitantly, she placed her blue knotted hand in his. She was still warm when they found her, although the life had fled her body, and only half the peas were shelled.
That was Neil Gaiman in a cost reading from the book American Gods, published by HarperCollins. Gaiman has collaborated with many writers and illustrators during his career. One of the funniest products to come of those collaborations was a book called Good Omens, which Gaiman wrote with fantasy humorist Terry Pratchett. It's a satirical, apocalyptic tale that explores what would happen if the Antichrist were accidentally switched at birth. Although he died of early-onset Alzheimer's disease in March 2015, Pratchett left behind an incredible body of work. He's best known for his 41 Discworld novels, which blend fantasy and humor to satirize the world we live in. Gaiman says he met Pratchett early in his writing career.
I think I was the first journalist ever to interview Terry about his book, The Color of Magic.
The two hit it off right away.
We realized we had the same kind of sense of humor, the same kind of intelligence, the same kind of knowledge.
The two authors stayed friends and often shared ideas about things they were working on. Gaiman says he had started writing Good Omens, but he had to put it down for other projects. Pratchett called him one day and asked that either he sell him the idea or that they write the book together.
As far as I was concerned, this is an awful lot like Michelangelo calling you up and saying, yeah, do you want to paint a chapel ceiling with me? You know that you're working with a craftsman. You know you're working with somebody who, as far as I was concerned, was a genius. It was like being, you know, apprenticed to a master craftsman. And I would write stuff and I'd send it over to Terry and he'd phone me up. He'd say, you know, if you change this word, it'll be 17% funnier.
Gaiman and Pratchett shared a fondness for libraries. There's even a recurring librarian character in Pratchett's Discworld novels who inhabits a world of books alive with magic. Gaiman has spoken at length in the past about his love of libraries and offered his thoughts about their future in the digital age.
I think the heartbreaking thing about libraries in this era of new technology is they are becoming more important, not less.
Gaiman points out that libraries are often the only places that people who don't have access to the internet can go to connect to the digital world. He also points to the changing role of librarians. They used to serve as navigators in an ocean of printed knowledge.
Information was hard to find, and it was hard to find because it was like a flower growing in a desert. You know, you had a long way to walk, but a librarian could take you to the flower. Now, it's more like flowers growing in the Amazon jungle. You're trying to find a specific flower. Anyone who has spent 5 minutes Googling for information and just sees the amount of noise out there starts to realize that actually somebody who knows what they're doing is incredibly useful. And librarians know what they're doing.
Gaiman once described himself as a feral child raised by libraries. He credits much of his success as a writer to the safe place they provided while he was growing up. Gaiman has advocated for libraries for groups like the Reading Agency, a charity in Britain that supports literacy programs. He does this, he says, because, as he wrote in an article for The Guardian, quote, everything changes when we read. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Jesse Wright.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're hearing from writers speaking about Appalachia. Award-winning author Charles Frazier was born in Asheville, North Carolina, and spent time as a teacher before he published his first novel, Cold Mountain, in 1997. The novel is based on his great-great-uncle, a wounded Confederate soldier who deserted his troop to journey back home to his loved ones. Cold Mountain would go on to win the National Book Award for Fiction, top the New York Times bestseller list, and be turned into an award-winning feature film in 2003. Last year, Frazier visited Shepherd University, where West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Liz McCormick sat down with him to talk about his work.
So first, what I want to ask you, obviously you have a passion for writing about Appalachia. Can you explore a little bit for me where that love comes from, of why you love writing in Appalachia?
Well, the landscape of the Southern Mountains really just speaks to me. And I grew up among them, among the mountains in western North Carolina, and have partly through the novels I've written learned more about the human history of that part. But the people. I mean, when I was a kid, there were still old time mountaineers who were 19th century people. My grandfather was born in something like 1880. The date's not certain on that. So he was an adult before the 20th century came around, and I think a lot about those people and how they were different from us. You know, one of the things that I always want to try to avoid and combat is that hillbilly stereotype that still lives.
I understand that Inman, one of the protagonists in Cold Mountain, is based on an ancestor of your family. I'm curious, does your passion for Civil War and Civil War history come from your family history, or does it come from something else?
Well, the core of Cold Mountain came from a family story that I heard from my father. But the part of doing that book was, I wasn't so much interested in the Civil War. I was interested in the effect of the war on people in my part of the world. And to do the book, I had to learn a lot of the things that they would have known and taken for granted. Just the names of plants. You walk through the woods, my grandmother could name every plant you saw. Just the physical culture of the place, just how people lived, the kinds of how houses were built, log cabins, all of that kind of detail. What kind of tools did you use to do that with? What were their names? I love that part of the job. So a lot of it was trying to understand just how they lived in very concrete physical detail.
What was one of the most interesting things that you discovered as you researched for Cold Mountain about the aftermath of the Civil War?
One thing I remember that I found really fascinating was I read a lot of letters from soldiers back home, letters from wives at home to their husbands, and you'd see the same pattern over and over of early in the war, wives writing to their husbands saying, we're getting really low on cash. I'm thinking about selling a cow. Do I have your permission? Later in the war, those same women write letters informing their husbands that they have sold the cow. And that growing sense of independence, of confidence that I think I saw in those letters was interesting to me, and certainly shows up in Cold Mountain.
Do you think, as you were researching and as you were working on the book, do you think that the Civil War itself caused that kind of cultural shift in women being a little bit more independent in their choices and not always seeking permission from their husbands? Or was it something that was happening anyway?
I mean, just off the top of my head, it sort of feels like war frequently accelerates something that may already have been building in the culture. And if you look at World War I, right after that you had the Jazz Age, women's clothing totally changed, you know, their sense of freedom changed. And then in World War II, you know, the same thing, women at home working for the war effort, you know, the Rosie the Riveter kind of thing, really just accelerated the sense of women's rights, women's equality, all of that that then began to take hold in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. And I notice with Ada's character growth in the story, she starts out as so demure and not really knowing how to do things, and then by the end of the story, she is very independent and can figure things out. She can shoot things for herself. And is it important to you as an Appalachian writer to portray Appalachian women characters as strong?
Well, it is. I mean, it's not like I plan it or anything, but I just base my characters on women I knew, Appalachian women I knew growing up, and they pretty much were all these tough women. I mean, at my grandparents' farm, there was always a rifle on pegs over the back door, and if there was a copperhead or a rattlesnake in the backyard, it was usually my grandmother who would grab that rifle because she was a better shot.
In your writing, and as you work on a story and as you develop it and you're doing the research, what do you find the most challenging when it comes to doing that research on Appalachia and making it real?
Well, when I was working on Cold Mountain, it was a whole different ballgame because there was hardly anything available on the internet at that time. I mean, I could maybe find out whether a book was checked out or not at a library, but that was about it. And now a lot of that primary source material has been digitized, and it's much easier to find that kind of thing. It sometimes to me feels a little bit like cheating, somehow not to have to take 2 hours to uncover something on a roll of microfiche or something. But it's always, for me, it's finding the voices of people involved in what I'm writing about. I just found recently, I'm writing about Jefferson Davis's second wife, and not so much the Civil War part of her life, but her life following the fall of Richmond, where she was a fugitive and they had bounties on their heads, and she was by herself with just a couple other people trying to escape to Cuba through Georgia and Florida. And I found a handwritten journal digitized by University of North Carolina, not transcribed or anything, so you have to figure out the 19th century handwriting. But a thing like that I can spend hours with and just get a much more concrete, detailed sense of what that experience was from those primary sources.
And Charles, my last question I want to ask you is, what is your absolute favorite thing about Appalachia?
Oh, I mean, really, if there's just one thing, being on a high place, you know, late in the afternoon, and just seeing a big long vista, like top of Klingman's Dome, that kind of huge, almost 360-degree vista, I think would be my absolute favorite thing. And if you've had to walk all day to get to that vista, that's even better.
That was author Charles Frazier speaking with Liz McCormick. Next, we'll hear from another fiction writer who grew up in Appalachia who says she always wanted to write about faraway lands. Anne Pancake's first novel portrays a family living near a mountaintop removal mine. It's called Strange as This Weather Has Been, and it's one of the most popular Appalachian novels of the past decade. From the Inside Appalachia archives, here she is reading from that novel in an interview with Andrew Carroll.
So this section is in the first chapter of the novel, and it's narrated by one of the main characters named Lace, and I think from here on out it's pretty self-explanatory. So when I was in 11th grade and they brought in a guidance counselor from away from here and I ended up doing work study for her second period, it proved what I'd known all along about my own specialness and how southern West Virginia was just a holding pen for me. Mrs. Claylock always seemed nervous, and she only lasted 2 years, but in that time, she figured out not only was I smart, but really good at tests. Us cooped up in that supplies closet they gave Mrs. Claylock for an office, cloudy with her strange perfume. I never smelled that perfume again until a department store in North Carolina, and when I did, Mrs. Claylock came so clear I could see the acne scars on her chin. Mrs. Claylock told me how to apply for college. Then she went even further and fixed me up with scholarships and grants. And the day I graduated high school, May 1983, I told myself once I got to WVU, I'd never look back. Truth was, though, after a month away, I was feeling a kind of lonesomeness I'd never known there was. I'd start drinking in my dorm room most evenings, stretch out on my window ledge on the 8th floor of Tower 2, a rum and coke between my legs, or a bottle of Mad Dog 2020. And if anybody asked, I'd say I was just warming up for that night's party. But really, I'd be watching the ridges in the distance. It was like I was all the time feeling I wasn't touching nothing, and wasn't nothing touching me back. And yeah, they had hills in Morgantown, but not back home hills, and not the same feel back home hills wrap you in. I'd never understood that before, had never even known the feel was there, until I left out and knew it by its absence.
And also part of Lace's realization that she's someplace different and has a different connection to where she's from. Do you think that she kind of has that realization, like, I'm from something special, and that pulls on me and it, you know, draws me back in really interesting ways? Do you think that's something that is kind of special to West Virginians, that we either while we're there or when we leave, we discover that there's something different?
Yeah, it's really mysterious. I think it's probably true also for some people in Kentucky and Tennessee, so I think it's Appalachian, but it seems even stronger in West Virginia, this constant pull to come back, but also a constant push to leave. I think that's also, so most of us live, I think, with that contradiction, both the attraction of the place and the repulsion of the place. So like I say, it's kind of mysterious. It's very powerful, and you can see it in the number of people who try to come back after they've left for work and, you know, come back to retire. And you see it in the younger people who are feeling the pull to leave. And I think you see it in people who never leave, because I think there's a lot of hurt in West Virginia, and there's a lot of beauty in West Virginia. And so to grow up holding both, you know, that beauty and that loss and hurt develops this kind of paradoxical relationship to identity and to land that a lot of us have.
That was fiction writer Anne Pancake speaking with Andrew Carroll back in 2015. Poet Nikki Giovanni says there are a few reasons she loves Appalachia, the region where she was born. An activist for civil rights and social justice, Giovanni was helping give voice to African-American Appalachians decades before Frank X. Walker coined the term Afrolachian. We discussed that group of poets in another episode of Inside Appalachia, so make sure you go back to our show last November to learn more about Afrolachian poetry. Liz McCormick spoke with Nikki Giovanni about her love for Appalachia and about growing up in Knoxville, Tennessee. From the Inside Appalachia archives, let's listen to their conversation, which begins with Giovanni reading one of her poems called Knoxville, Tennessee.
I always liked summer best. You can eat fresh corn from Daddy's garden, and okra and greens and cabbage, and lots of barbecue and buttermilk and homemade ice cream at the church picnic, and listen to gospel music outside at the church homecoming, and go to the mountains with your grandmother, and go barefooted and be warm all the time, not only when you go to bed and sleep. I'm a Knoxvillian by birth, and I spent most of my summers with my grandmother, and then I actually moved in with my grandparents, so yeah, I love this.
I love that poem, too. And can you talk a little bit about, in terms of Appalachia, how does this poem mean to you?
I just love it because, you know, there was always a garden. You always had something that your parents were growing. And I grew up being used to or having gardens. And, of course, I grew up also cooking with my grandmother. And grandmother would, you know, we'd go out and pick a tomato or go out and pick some peppers. Or, you know, we'd always have something that we were putting from the garden into the food that we were actually eating. So it always made sense to me. I don't do, and I guess I shouldn't say that, but I don't do fast food. I don't, uh, I know that whatever I do with a drive-thru in a car is not food, so I don't do that, you know.
And so we don't have your poem, When Gone Made Mountains, to recite, but could you talk a little bit about it? And if you remember any specific parts of it that stick out to you, if you could just talk a little bit about that poem.
Well, I'm actually a history major, so I've always been interested in how things evolve. And in thinking about West Virginia particularly, we cannot look at the history of the United States without recognizing the importance of West Virginia seceding from Virginia. The Civil War would have been an entirely different affair if the Union had lost control of these mountains, and we know that. And when God made mountains, I wanted to deal with why he was deciding to do that, aside from fresh water and stuff. He had to make a place, and of course you can't talk about the United States without talking about runaway slaves. And without these mountains, you know, this was the one place, West Virginia, what became West Virginia, was the one place that a runaway slave, let's say you were coming up Alabama, you could come up and you could follow the water, and you could follow the water north. And in following the water north, you're going to get up here. These are going to be the people who are not going to turn you in. They're not going to turn you back. They're not going to sell you back. They're going to say, welcome. Actually, as you know, West Virginia is quite rich, and yet West Virginians have not benefited from that. Almost everybody in the world has benefited from the richness of this state, from its wood to its forest to its oil to any number of things that are here. And yet West Virginians have not benefited from that. We have taken that away. And I think that one of the things that the country doesn't like is the fact that West Virginia stood up for freedom when nobody else was standing up for freedom, when it wasn't of benefit for them to stand up for freedom. It was the right thing to do. And I think the country's been upset with West Virginia ever since, frankly speaking.
What was the initial kind of push for you to decide to express yourself through poetry in what you stand for, in your activism, and just expressing yourself? Why was it poetry that you chose?
I really don't know. It's just all I really know is what I dream and what I think. And, of course, people of my generation, we all, you know, picketed and we did the things that one should do. And that was a good thing to do. But I also just had these dreams and I wanted to share them. And I had these ideas and I kept thinking something is missing. We have a bastardized history of West Virginia that has to be corrected. And it's time that West Virginians realize that we can't let other people say what our history is. We have to look at what it is. And I know the same thing is true of Black Americans, that we can't just look at what was done to us. We have to look at and what good came out of this. And so as we look at America, we have to look at what is marginalized and figure out what and who has been marginalized and how and why that happens.
What are some of your observations of race relations and civil rights in the Appalachian region compared to the rest of the country? And if you can give some similarities and some contrasts.
I think historically, Appalachians have been friends to freedom. And I think we can show that. And we show it through some things that are really quite easy. We show it through the banjo, because the banjo is endemic to West Africa. And so the only way that anybody in Appalachia can play a banjo that knows the banjo is that Africans or those who were enslaved and escaping came up here. We know things like okra, you know, came from Africa. And of course, I live in Virginia. I teach at Virginia Tech. And Virginia prides itself on being the peanut capital of the world. Well, peanuts or West African. And so whatever Virginia has learned about peanuts, they learned that through the people they enslaved. So we have a communication, and the communication has been good. We can look at how we dress, and we can look at how we dance. I think that if I may, the white Americans in Appalachia, here in West Virginia, in these mountains, have been a friend of freedom. And I think that it's time we celebrate it.
Continuing with kind of the idea of with civil rights and activism and race relations, looking at today with kind of the things that have been going on, police brutality, the Black Lives Matter movement, and the debate over the Confederate flag, and much more. Can you share some of your thoughts on what's going on today in our country?
Well, clearly, some of it's sad. I have never understood the reason that policemen need guns. I still don't. And I, you know, the crooks will do whatever. But you don't need power and authority. Nobody does. And I have disliked the idea of policemen having guns because they already have authority. And somebody could call in and say, well, you know, Nikki, if the cops don't have guns, somebody will shoot them. But if the cops don't have guns, then the citizens will protect them. There's no question about that. And when we start to look at the inner cities particularly, we know, or we should know, that one of the things we want is we want the policemen, or the police people, I should say, to have a partner. We know that we don't want just the white policemen to be out there, a couple of them, and then they're shooting people for no reason. Everybody's upset. We want a white and a black. We want a man and a woman. We want a continual mix of who these people are. And as I said, we want them to be without guns. The Confederate flag is a segregationist flag. What is being called the Confederate flag came up actually as a response to the civil rights, which shows both stupidity about who we are as a nation and who we are as a people. If I had my way, starting first grade, every American child would learn another language. And I think that every American child, and I'm just not trying to speak for the world, but I think that every American child should know how to swim. It's just something that we should make sure that every kid in America, and I don't know if we have to even wait till first grade for that one, you know, and we need to get those kids there to teach them how to swim because these are skills. I would like to see every American kid starting kindergarten, first grade, play some sort of instrument. I think it'd be great, and whatever instrument they want, whether it's a piano, whether it's a saxophone, it doesn't matter. And in a generation, we would have an American child that could go any place on earth and be at home.
Do you think, compared to when you started in the civil rights movement back in the 60s, how do you feel about of today, what's going on today, to what you were working on back then?
Life is always about the going forward. And I think that I grew up in segregation. And it was really, I had to laugh. I was in Knoxville, Tennessee, I don't know now, 5 years ago, some, you know, it's been a while. And I was invited to speak at the Tennessean Theater, which is there on Gay Street. And it's now historic. But it was so wonderful because I remember when I wasn't during the era of segregation, you weren't allowed. But you can't compare what we did 100 years ago, what we did 50 years ago, and how we're doing it. You have to say, are we approaching, are we engaged in the questions of our time? And are we working, if not to the best of our ability, to some of our ability to try to solve it? Mm-hmm. I think that has to be dealt with. I'm a big fan of Black Lives Matter because a lot of people have been casual about Black lives. So one lady up in Connecticut said white lives matter too, but nobody said that it didn't. That we've been casual about what happens with Black kids and with Black people. We can look at our prisons and see we have just too many people in prison. And the thing that makes America, and I don't think we're great now, but I think we are on the cusp of a greatness. The thing that makes us potentially great is that we are allowing human freedom. Mm-hmm. That we are in 21st century, we're saying, yeah, you should be able to make some decisions about your life and I should step back as long as you are a law-abiding citizen. You have a right to live your life. And it's so basic. It has nothing to do with what other people think, because when other people don't like it, they don't have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. It's that simple.
In your speech at Shepherd University, you had mentioned Appalachian happiness is very important. And I wanted to ask you to explore that a little bit more and tell me why you feel that way.
Well, the thing that I admire, I don't know if the term is going to be most, but certainly way at the top of my list, is I admire the fact that you stand for freedom. And I admire the fact that we in Appalachia, and I'm going to include myself in that, have a concept of enough. And that's a concept that we are going to have to actually be able to share and spread across this country, because right now nobody has an idea of enough, which is why people are really being crazy to say, I want to be a billionaire. But actually, $1 million is enough, maybe even something lower than that. But we in Appalachia have an idea of enough, that this is, I'm satisfied, I'm pleased, I have a family, I have a decent house, I'm warm, you know, whatever it is, we have a concept of enough. And that idea that Appalachia brings to us, and Appalachia brings it to our country, that idea is what has to permeate, America.
And I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this already, but I'm just going to ask it anyway. Do you feel like you're an Appalachian?
Well, I'm a Knoxvillian by birth, so yes, I am. I don't have any problem with being an Appalachian, but I'm also an American, and I'm also an earthling. And when we look at West Virginia, we are also looking at the future, because almost everything that has to do with space has come from people from this state. And I think that, again, sitting in at night in the dark sky watching it, you know, this is where the dreams come from. And so our rocket people, I mean, you can look at how many of our rocket people are West Virginians who have come from here. They said, well, some want to be an engineer, some want to be poets. You need both. If we're going to go to Mars, you're going to need both.
That was poet Nikki Giovanni speaking with Liz McCormick back in 2015. There's a certain sense of security and comfort with these mountains. It's not perfect. We have our flaws, but true love takes the good with the bad and finds beauty in flaws. We heard from some writers with a love for this place, too, and recognized some things they might not agree with. When you love someone, you don't just give up on them. Maybe that's why this place has inspired some strong voices in writing. We'd love to hear your Appalachian love letter, or perhaps a haiku poem. Just send us a tweet at InAppalachia and use the hashtag MyAppalachia. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky. Music in today's show was provided by Ben Townsend, Dinosaur Burps, and Michael Howard. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.